All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. This hour will help investors fix issues and achieve personal gain. Now, here's your host, Jay Taylor.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor. I'm talking to you from Queens in the borough of Queens, New York City on the 22nd day of December, 2020. And I do want to take advantage of this day to wish all of my friends of various faiths and non-faiths, whatever, a Merry Christmas and a Happy Hanukkah and a Happy New Year. Let's hope it's a happier New Year than the very eventful 2020 was. It's been a very difficult year, but we're going to do our best to get through the end of it and hopefully look for better times in 2021. And I want to thank all of you for listening to this show and make this show one of the more popular shows in Voice America Business Channel. Also, to remind you that I published a newsletter called Mining Jay Taylor's Gold, Energy, and Tech Stocks. Go to miningstocks.com to sign up for that. And it is a good time, for sure, to be invested in the exploration sector, the gold and silver exploration sector. Some very, very exciting things happening, and I'll tell you about one of them in just a moment. Also, like to encourage you to consider signing up for Chen Lin's letter, What is Chen Buying, What is Chen Selling? Really doing extremely well with some biotech stocks, a couple of which I'm starting to follow myself. Very interesting stories. Chen has done excellent, has done really, really well in that sector, and he passes that on to his subscribers at ChenPix.com. Go to ChenPix.com. What is Chen buying? What is Chen selling? And Michael Oliver is with us today. We're really pleased about that. It's OliverMSA.com to sign up for his letter, the best technical letter that I've ever read and ever subscribe to. It's really great. It's very, very helpful, at least for me as a person who isn't a real short-term trader. I do make trades from time to time, and I'm not just strictly a buy-and-hold guy, but to know which side of the market is going up and which side is going down over the longer run is very, very helpful. And Michael is just the best I've ever seen in helping in that regard. Want to thank our sponsors, because without them, there would be no show. Today's sponsors, Benchmark Metals, NV Gold, Cassiar Gold Corp, Hannon Metals, Irving Resources, Noble Resources, Sitka Gold Corp, Lion One Metals, and SK Mining Corp. And speaking of SK Mining, the stock has exploded upwards earlier this morning, up by 44% today on some fantastic drill results from its SK project, the VMS deposit in British Columbia that Quentin Henning told us about a few weeks back. And that is one you're going to want to keep your eyes on, I think. It's down a little bit from its highs now as the gold price has backed off and the equity markets, at least the precious metals markets, have backed off a bit from their highs earlier this morning. But this is a real deal. I think that you're going to see SK Mining be a name that you hear a lot more about on this show going forward. Also performing well today is Sitka Gold, which has completed its drill projects in the Yukon, and Corwin Coe will be with me in the second segment of today's show to give us an update not only on that company's Yukon project, but also on projects in Arizona and Nevada that the company is working on and is drilling this year and will be into next year, presumably. Well, after President Nixon closed the gold window in 1971, the U.S. dollar retained its value despite massive expenditures undertaken by the U.S. to expand its empire. The dollar retained its value through diplomatic arrangements with Saudi Arabia to force nations around the world to pay for oil in dollars. So to enforce that, the U.S. military was used in countries like Iraq and Libya It has seemed since that fateful August 15th, 1971 date when Richard Nixon took gold away from the dollar that we have created an infinite number of dollars, and it seems as though that could go on forever. But Lynn Alden, who will be with me in the second half of today's show, says that built into the petrodollar system is a self-decaying mechanism that is now suggesting the dollar's days may be numbered. And it is certainly very interesting to note that last week's main guest, Alistair MacLeod, has written an extremely important essay titled "The Next Dollar Problem Has Just Arrived." The next dollar problem has just arrived, and I would suggest that that you definitely want to read that article. You can quickly go and find the link to that article by going to miningstocks.com. Alistair spells out the market mechanics that is showing that the number of dollars now being created is starting to explode dramatically higher, suggesting the start of a hyperinflation of the currency may now be getting underway. In fact, he points out that M1 has grown 14%, not 14% per annum, 14% over a two-week period the last 2 weeks. So this is something really, I think, of concern. And you should keep an eye on. A hyperinflated currency is by no means anything to celebrate. I don't care how high gold goes. The chaos that will surround anything like a hyperinflation is not something anybody in their right mind would hope for. But it's better to be aware of it before anything else, before everyone else catches on. Because I'm telling you, when the masses start to figure this out, it's going to be like trying to force Niagara Falls through a garden hose. It's just you want to be there before the masses figure it out. I'm not sure that Lynn Alden views the dollar in such dramatic terms as Alistair does right now, but we'll ask her about that, certainly. But certainly we will talk to her about that and many other issues. And as I mentioned, Corwin Cole will be with me right after the first commercial break. But right now I'm really happy to tell you that Michael Oliver is with me once again. Thanks for joining me, Michael.
Hi, Jay.
You know, it's really good to hear your voice every other week and to hear where you think things are going. And I know that one of the things that I've been watching pretty carefully, in part because Lynn Alden has talked to us about it, and, Alistair MacLeod is suggesting that Bitcoin's recent dramatic rise has got to have something to do with this, with a growing understanding, perhaps among millennials, that the dollar's days are numbered, or at least the dollar is going to just expand infinitely, almost, to try to finance all the stuff the government tries to finance. And so, I bought some Bitcoin, and you know, it's just crazy to watch it. I mean, CBGT is the trust that holds it. And it's very exciting, but I'd like to hear what you have to say, because I know you were very timely on it. I remember you put out a piece that was very timely, and people who bought it then have done very well. But what are your thoughts on Bitcoin, and then maybe just talk to us about gold and the dollar and anything else that might you think is important?
Well, Bitcoin is sort of philosophically and economically an interesting phenomenon because, I mean, it is a competitor to statist currencies. And that could be its problem. That's its virtue, but it also could be its problem. MSA has called the major turns in Bitcoin very well. We called the top when it came out, started trading. We said it would collapse to 5,000. At that time, it was 20,000. In fact, it went to 3,200. Then when it came up out of the hole at about just above 5,000, we went long-term bullish again. And we've had some secondary buy signals on the way up, and now it's back to the highs and slightly new highs. Fine. It doesn't have a lot of history. So people who say, it's doing better than gold. Well, it depends on what point in time you want to measure. If you go back to when Bitcoin came on the board in December 2017 on the CME as a futures contract, it's gained some ground. Okay. Uh-huh. But it came back to where it was, and now it's gotten above it. Gold's had an enormous percent move from that same point in time in late 2017. So it depends on when you want to measure. You know, day-to-day is not good. There's simply not enough history to make a macro-technical assumption about Bitcoin going to be stronger than gold. My concern, and there are others in the gold, pro-gold arena, I don't want to speak for them, but Fleckenstein, for example, and there's others who have some skepticism about the ultimate viability of Bitcoin. There's one reason that I'm concerned about, and that is if, in fact, cryptocurrencies do rise in terms of the percent usage of cryptocurrencies globally by the public, by industry, etc., they become a competitor to central bank-issued paper. And therefore, if they become a competitor of gravitas, you know, enough percentage, then central bank monetary and interest rate policies become less and less important because their currencies aren't as important to the world and to the trading community. And so, in effect, you're attacking the viability of government currencies. And at some point, my suspicion is the statists will not put up with it. If it ever becomes a threat on a percentage basis to their policy, the wave effects of their policy, they'll do a Roosevelt on it, meaning ban it, turn your gold in, okay? And I, because of the nature of cryptocurrencies, I think they can access it and actually take steps to curtail it. I defy them to ever attempt to do that to gold again. I don't think it would. That's not an option that the public would put up with. But the cryptocurrencies, because they are focused and you know they're on the net and so forth, and I think probably the governments would have a way of regulating or sidelining the cryptocurrencies. I don't. This is speculation on my part, but I can see that cryptocurrencies could be a threat to government monetary policy. And, no, and they therefore.
They may want to use them themselves. They may want to use them themselves.
Yeah, and they may want to co-opt it. Okay, you get a U.S. cryptocurrency. In fact, the Fed has been mentioning this.
Yeah.
So,
I guess.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I guess one of the objections to what you're saying, I hear from some of the younger folks, is they don't think the government can crack down. But I don't know. I mean, governments can do almost anything they want. They certainly have the ability, I would think, to crack down. But, you know, I don't know.
It's something to think about, whereas I don't think this day and age you can do a Roosevelt on the gold market.
Why is that, Michael? Because it seems to me, I mean, what percentage of the American public own gold? I don't know. It doesn't strike me as though it's a large
percent. It's a growing percent. Let me put it that way. I think it's a growing percent, including people who aren't even gold people.
Yeah,
I bet George Soros owns a ton of gold. Okay?
Oh, for sure. But George Soros may be running the government as far as we know. So he may say, I want your gold too.
Anyway, I feel more secure with gold and silver. In fact, I think silver is going to be the leader over the next couple of years. And our view of gold is that you've probably now seen the corrective low, the pullback low. And in the case of silver, you've seen the bottom end of the range low because it really – it had multiple sell-offs in silver, but they all went to the same place and stopped. They never continued down. And I think that the silver action last week and gold have set the stage now for the balance of power to shift the other way back to the upside, meaning the intermediate correction has done its thing, and the next step is to emerge from this clump of ink and put on the next leg. And unlike prior bull markets in gold that lasted, 5 and 10 years, I think that due to other macroeconomic and technical factors in other markets like the dollar, stock markets, bond markets, that gold could very well approach the underside of $10,000 an ounce in a year and a half.
Wow. So
and
I guess
silver,
maybe
you can speculate where silver might be, but it could be hundreds of dollars an ounce. I think that the lid is going to come off big time. We're not going to have a regular bull market.
Well, then you might be more in Alistair McLeod's camp, seeing the wheels coming off this wagon fairly rapidly and fairly soon.
Yeah.
I hope and pray that's not the case, but it is what it is, and we want to be ready for it as much as possible. In 30 seconds, Michael, can you just give me an idea? You put out something pretty bullish on oil, I think, this week.
Well, oil is we're not all that bullish. We're bullish on oil. We're bullish on natural. We're bullish on almost all commodities now. They've all turned corners. So is the Bloomberg Commodity Index. What we really like in the energy sector are some of the oil sector ETFs, oil services, oil gas exploration ETFs, as in terms of what we think their percent gain could be over a short-term period of time. So as oil is turned up now into positive trend, it's not going to gain the kind of percentages that these extremely beat-up oil sectors have suffered. I mean, you've taken sectors to like 5% of their value compared to 5 years ago, that kind of thing. They've like crashed them off the page. It's like, oh, we don't need oil services anymore. Well,
yeah.
the vacuum effect alone, technically speaking, could drive some of these ETFs up, 100, 200%. And I hate to tell you what that would do to some call options.
If you own them, you don't hate it.
We are excited about oil, but primarily oil sector ETFs, meaning the companies.
Okay. Very good. Very good point. All right, Michael, we'll have to leave it go at that. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and your ideas with us. Always a pleasure to have you, and we'll look forward to talking to you in another couple of weeks.
Thank you, Jay.
All righty. Folks, we do have to go to break, but Corwin Coe will be with me. He is the CEO of Sitka Gold Corp, and so we'll be right back with Corwin to talk about three of his projects, actually four, I think it is, in Canada and the United States that are doing very well. So we'll be right back with Corwin Coe.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
Benchmark Metals is an advanced gold-silver exploration company that is rapidly advancing its Canadian gold-silver project to a production decision. Benchmark is nearing completion of its largest program to date, with up to 100,000 meters of resource expansion and definition drilling in 2020. The multi-million ounce potential project is expected to have a new mineral resource estimate and PEA study completed in 2021. The company is backed by the Metals Group management team and believes this aggressive program will be complemented by one of the strongest commodity bull markets in decades. Visit BenchmarkMetals.com and subscribe to follow their success.
Cassiar Gold Corp. trades on the OTCQB under the symbol CGLCF and on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol GLDC. Its flagship asset, the Cassiar Gold Project, is a large advanced stage road-accessible gold property with an NI 43-101 compliant resource estimate of 1 million ounces at 1.43 grams per ton gold at the Taurus near-surface bulk tonnage gold deposit and 15 kilometers of high-grade gold prospects. The property hosts several past producing high-grade gold mines and is in search for the next multi-million ounce gold camp in British Columbia.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me Corwin Coe. Corwin is the CEO and a member of the board of directors of Sitka Gold Corp., and he is a geologist. He's had many years of experience looking for precious metals, and he's in the hunt for at least four projects that Sitka is operating, is exploring and developing this year. Sitka trades in Toronto. SIG is the symbol there. You can buy it down here in the States, as I have, under the symbol SITKF. 57.2 million shares, 18 cents in Canadian money. I'm looking on my screen now in U.S. money, about 15 cents. Well, it gives it a market cap of around, well, I guess in Canadian money, around $10 million, something like that. So thanks for joining me again, Cor. It's really good to have you with me.
Thank you, Jay. Yeah, it's a different environment than the last time we talked, where the power outage happened, and I wasn't able to get online with you there.
Yeah, that's right. You had a big storm up there, and we had to cancel. So you've got there were three projects that I know about, and you're telling me there's a fourth one in the UK. Well, okay, so you've got the RC property and another project called the OGI property in the Yukon. And it, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you love all your children, you love all your properties, but I think the one you were most excited about was RC Gold. But talk to us about what's going on in the Yukon with those two properties and what you've accomplished this year and what you hope to do next year.
Yeah, Jay, so first off, we've had four drill programs this year, one in mm-hmm. our property in Nevada, one in Arizona at the Burrow Creek, a major one at RC Gold, and then the newly acquired OGI property also in the Yukon. We've been focused on the Yukon for the last few months, and we finally got all of our drill results back, and we've got a spectacular gold discovery there that has just got us very excited. We ended up putting four drill holes into an area over a 2-kilometer length, and they all came back with gold from surface all the way to the bottom of the holes with grades that were comparable to Victoria Gold's property that just went in production up there. We had some grades like 59 meters at 0.88 grams per ton, 100 meters at 0.82. And interestingly enough, we even had high grade. One of the holes bottomed in 2 meters of 16.1 grams per ton gold. High grade component there too. But I think what's, to put this in perspective, this gold find, this is an intrusion-related identified target. And on our northern property is a deposit called the Red Mountain deposit. And I was involved with that when they initially drilled that. And it had a gold anomaly of around 100 ppd gold and about a 300-meter by 100-meter footprint. This target that we've got has over 500 ppb gold anomaly that stretches at least 2 kilometers and is 500 meters wide. So for us to stick four holes in there and end up with these kind of values, it just shocked us, and we realized we've got something that potentially could be very large. So yeah, we're excited about the RC Gold property, absolutely.
So you're looking at a bulk mineable target, I guess. It really looks like it could be very, very large if there's continuity there, but with some potential for high grade underneath, possibly?
Exactly. Now, these holes, we put these four holes in. They went down about 300 meters on an average, and they were angled around 45 to 55 degrees. They also followed the topography from the top of the mountain down. So when you're at the bottom of one of these holes and you're 300 meters from surface, you're from the drill collar, you're only around 100 meters from surface because the drops off in both directions. So this is an potentially open pittable environment.
Yeah.
And you know, that's very significant. Absolutely.
Sure. Yeah. Low stripping ratio. All right, so what about the OGI then in the Yukon?
So the OGI, we moved in there in September and drilled four drill holes into a zinc-silver anomaly that has the indications of potentially being a SEDEX-type deposit. It never had any drilling before. There's been a little bit of trenching done, but that was not very successful because of the permafrost. And so we went in there and drilled four holes over this anomaly that also has some geophysics overlaying it. This anomaly is about 700 meters in length and about 200 meters wide, with a silver of around 1 ounce per ton in the soils and about 0.5% zinc. So a very strong signature, and those assays are still pending. The results.
So with regard to the Yukon, what will you be doing? I suppose you'll be in the process of setting up your drill programs, and then you'll let us all know what you're planning to do there, or do you know already?
Well, we know that we're going to have a very aggressive drill program on the saddled Egger zone over that 2-kilometer area. It's still open in length and depth, and we want to put enough drill holes in there to put a maiden resource out at the end of the year. So
wow,
we're talking,
okay,
you know, a minimum of 10,000 meters and possibly 20,000 meters just on that target, which is a tiny portion of our district scale property that is 376 square kilometers. I mean, it's just, there's so much potential on that, on the RC Gold property. This is just one of many targets that we want to follow up with. But this is shaping up much faster than we anticipated with these results.
Well, that sure sounds exciting. Then with respect to Burrow Creek, what do you have in store for there? That's your most advanced project.
Yeah,
at this
Burrow
stage.
Creek, we completed 10 drill holes and completed those in April this year. And that was successful in proving that the Burrow Creek vein, which hosts the historical deposit, continues to the south for what we believe is at least a kilometer and a half or a mile. And we stepped out and fenced our holes right to the end of the patented property. And then we're in the process of permitting with the BLM to continue fencing out the other about a kilometer left to drill there. So that was very successful too. And some of the results we got were definitely exactly what we would have expected being the Burrow vein. We had like 41 meters at 1.15 grams per ton gold and 51.3 grams per ton silver. And in there's a high grade component in this deposit too. Like we had one hole that ran 1.07 meters of 17.55 grams per ton gold and 33 grams per ton silver. So we're very pleased with what we've accomplished down there at our Arizona property to date, and we're anxious to get going and step out and show that this deposit, this historical deposit of 5 million ounces of silver and 120,000 ounces of gold, could be much larger, and we want to be able to do that and then do a resource calculation based on our new drilling.
And you mean by next year, or would it be in 2023 when you do the resource?
We're hoping to get our permits and be drilling down there this winter, and that would enable us to do a resource calculation probably midsummer by the time we get our results done. So that is our flagship property because it already has a foundation of a deposit there from the past. I mean, I was involved with that in 1988. And we had all the permits. We were going to put it in production, and gold was at $400 an ounce, and slid off down to $250, and it got shelved. So, so it's definitely a lower risk than any of our other projects. But now RC Gold is starting to kind of nudge up there too. We're obviously onto something pretty big there.
And then you still have another property, which is more of a, let's say a wild card, or let's say, what do you call it? Your Alpha project, which is a Carlin target, and you had a deep drill hole that you put down there this year. I believe it sort of wandered off in the wrong direction, perhaps.
We went down 1,700 and some feet, or 545 meters, I think, and it was very successful in a lot of ways. It proved the structural interpretation that the lower plate carbonates were preserved there. It gave us anomalous gold with coinciding mercury in several sections of the drill hole that are a Carlin signature. And so we believe that that's leakage from the lower plate carbonate that we were wanting to tap into. And that information has been very valuable in helping us pinpoint where we're putting our second drill hole there.
And you're planning to do that next year?
Yes, we're planning on doing that in a few weeks. Everything comes together. Alpha is a very high-risk target, but being right in the Carlin gold belt there, it's just very compelling to move forward with that and test that structural interpretation that we have to date.
Give it a shot with at least one drill hole, and then I suppose if it's successful, you might do more there, I suppose.
Absolutely. We've got our permit for 10 drill holes in place there, and we're expanding on that as well based on the information that we've got to date. So Yeah, that's a fluid situation, and like most exploration programs, you have to be willing to pivot in short order when you're getting the right information. And again, that's why we're going to be focused pretty strongly on our Yukon RC project come this spring.
Mm-hmm. Well, it looks like you could really come up with some good data there based on four drill holes and hitting on each one of them, and as you've described it, over a large target. Go big or go home is a philosophy of many people that I think more successful people. Looks like you have a chance to go big there for sure, and who knows in Nevada. So you have a lot of things going on. How are you financed? Do you have enough money to do what you want to do next year, at least to start the year?
We have enough money to do what we want to do in Nevada and Arizona, but obviously a big aggressive program up in the Yukon is going to take more money. And we're looking at different options, not just equity financing. We're in discussions regarding convertible debt, pre-royalty sales, or maybe a combination of all three. So sure. Yeah, that's going to be a big program that is going to have to be looked at down the road. We're in the middle of putting our budget together right now on how many drill holes we want to put in that area to end up with enough to do a maiden resource there. And we need enough money there in that budget to follow up on two other gold discoveries we made. One with one of our other drill holes, aside from the Sylager area at the Big Creek anomaly, had never had a drill hole in that mountain before, and we ended up with some gold in the drill hole that needs to be followed up with. And then another area never had a drill hole, but the soils were strong, and we trenched there and ended up with 7 meters of 0.65 grams per ton gold, which again is right in the ballpark what we're looking for grade based on what is being successfully mined at Victoria Gold in that belt right now.
All right. We'll have to leave it go at that. Sounds like it's a story our listeners are going to want to keep in touch with going forward. So thank you so much, Cor, for being with us, and we'll look forward to catching up with you in the future again sometime soon.
Yeah, that sounds good. One thing I did want to mention, though, is Sitka also has a wholly owned subsidiary called Arctic Copper Corporation.
Yes.
And we've got our foot in the door with copper up in the Arctic there that it's in on our website and on our presentation, and it's pretty compelling target.
Wonderful.
Move forward with copper.
Okay. Well, we've got a lot to watch. Thank you so much, Cor. We do have to run now, but thank you so much for giving us this update. It's excellent.
Thanks.
All right,
for the
folks. You bet. Okay, folks, well, don't go away because Lynn Alden's going to be with me, and she has some really important things to talk about. The U.S. dollar and a paper she wrote, the fraying of the U.S. global currency reserve system. And very important stuff to hear from Lynn Alden. So we'll be right back with her right after the break.
Voice America is available on your Google connected device.
Okay, Google, play Turning Hard Times into Good Times podcast on iHeartRadio.
Try it today.
NV Gold Corp, trading under NVX on the TSX and NVGLF on the OTC, is a gold exploration company focused on uncovering the next multi-million ounce gold deposit in North America. With an aggressive exploration season ahead in 2020, a tight share structure, strong management ownership, key strategic investors including Eric Sprott, a globally recognized technical team, technical coverage from industry gold experts, and cash in its treasury. Visit nvgoldcorp.com to learn more on this exciting story.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and we're really pleased to have with me once again Lynn Alden. She's certainly become very well known in the financial world. A lot of people paying a lot of attention to her, and for good reason, because she really puts her skill set as an engineer and applies the same kind of critical, logical thinking to finance. And so her work is greatly appreciated by yours truly, and really pleased to have her with me again. It's Lynn Alden, LynAlden.com. Go there. There's a lot of free things, but she does have a very reasonably priced paid service as well for investors that I highly recommend, and I have taken advantage of myself. So thanks for joining me again, Lynn. It's really a pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks for having me again. Happy to be here.
Oh, it's really good to have you. And you really do a great job. This article that I wrote, it's about, oh gosh, I guess it's about 50-some pages or so, almost 60 pages or so, called The Fraying of the U.S. Global Currency Reserve System. You know, as you point out in your article, a lot of people have been saying for some time, have been harping or, you know, making sort of shallow claims about the dollar. The dollar's days are over, they're ending, the dollar is toast. You know, I think I've probably been guilty of saying that sometimes myself as a gold bug. But you point out in your article that there are some issues. I mean, there are really some built-in atrophy, really. Systems break down in the dollar, the financial system, the monetary system based on the petrodollar. It's certainly not perfect. It has a lot of flaws, and it's fraying, as you point out. But I'd like to start out by just asking you to explain, you know, how is the dollar referred to as the petrodollar?
Sure. So ever since the Bretton Woods system ended in 1971, currencies have been on a free floating exchange rate. And so basically that, you know, back then, the dollar is backed by gold, and then other currencies were pegged to the dollar. But when that system broke down, you know, these currencies all became fiat currencies. And then, you know, policymakers had a tough problem on their hands because, you know, there's dollar devaluation, there's, you know, widespread currency devaluation against gold. And then the United States had energy crises. And so one of the deals they made, which was that Saudi Arabia would sell their oil only in dollars. So no matter what country is buying from them, you know, if France buys oil from Saudi Arabia, even though it's neither of their currencies, they pay in the dollar. And then Saudi Arabia would reinvest a lot of those dollars into buying U.S. treasuries. In exchange for that, the U.S. can provide protection and various military deals and other sort of lucrative trade. And that extended to you know, most of OPEC. And so we've been in this nearly 50-year period where virtually all oil and most other commodities are priced in dollars globally. And that creates a situation where there's this artificial demand for the dollar, because every country needs dollars in order to procure energy and other commodities. And it was originally described as an exorbitant privilege, right? Because mm-hmm. the United States could print money and basically buy commodities in its own currency, and it was the only country that really could do that. But that also opened up problems. And so if you look at, say, the U.S. trade deficit over the very long term, it completely blew out right after the petrodollar system was created, right after Bretton Woods system ended. Mm-hmm. And so, because basically there's so much demand for the dollar, and so that makes it so that our imports, you know, we have a lot of importing power, but it makes our exporting competitiveness pretty weak. Mm-hmm. And it makes it so that the entire global system is really dependent on one country's currency. And then what's increasingly happening now is that in addition to all these trade deficits really messing up the United States' domestic economy, we also have, the fact that, you know, when this system was developed nearly 50 years ago, the United States was something like 35% of world GDP. And that's declined over time because, of course, we've had the rise of China, we've had the rise of various emerging markets. And now the United States is something like 20% of global GDP, But our currency is still, you know, pretty much the only currency used for global energy pricing. And so it's basically squeezing the rest of the world. And so we're starting to see alternative payment systems, right? Where so Russia has really spearheaded this, where they are increasingly selling their oil to Europe and to China in euros.
Mm-hmm. Right. Russia is doing that. And, of course, not making the United States very happy about that. But I'd like to ask you, why do you think Saudi Arabia would make this deal with the U.S.? Was there some sort of an exchange where the U.S. would ensure the ruling elite there, the royal family, perhaps? Or why did Saudi Arabia agree to do that, I wonder, with the U.S.?
Yeah, mainly that. It just established them in the region, and it gave them increased legitimacy and defense, and it also made it so that, you know, they could more easily ship oil around the world because they basically have the U.S. military backing their all the supply lines.
Mm-hmm. Right. So the U.S. military has been a part of this program as well, then, I guess, right? And I think you point out in the article, Saddam Hussein decided he wanted to get paid in euros and didn't want to just take dollars. That didn't end too well for him. I think maybe the same thing might have happened in Libya to Gaddafi. So the U.S. is sort of used its strong military presence around the world to keep open the sea lanes and to ensure that the dollar was continued to be used as a reserve currency. So that meant that we could then do what? We could create endless amounts of money to finance the empire, to expand the empire, to do what? I mean, I'm much older than you, Lynn, and I remember was a young man during Vietnam. And I remember when we went off the gold standard, a young man reading about it in the New York Times on 16th of August, 1971, and thinking, why in the world would other countries accept this? And at that time, the United States, was engaging in Vietnam, the war, and Lyndon Johnson had his Great Society program. All of that was going to cost a lot of money. And how do we pay for it? Well, the politicians weren't going to tax us, tell Americans they were going to have to raise their taxes to fight a war on the other side of the world. It wasn't going to tell us we had to raise our taxes to engage in socialism, which was something, especially back in those days, it was a no-no. I guess it was so that we could just expand. I mean, who benefited from this, I guess, is what I'm getting at. People closest to government, perhaps, the people that had contracts with the military. Why did the United States feel like we had to, to become this great empire?
Yeah, the overall system was really beneficial, mainly to people towards the top of the income ladder or the political ladder. And so it was beneficial to government. It was beneficial to major corporations, globalization, all of that. And the primary, people that really suffered from it were, parts of the middle class, especially people that work in manufacturing and other sort of, kind of hard asset type of work. And so basically, in order to make sure that there's a lot of dollars out in the world, the United States basically runs these really persistent trade deficits ever since the mid-70s. And so basically, we've outsourced a lot of our supply chains to China, to Europe, to Japan. And so it's not just a developed market to emerging market phenomenon, because many other developed markets like Japan and Germany have not experienced this to the same degree that the United States has. It's really been highly tied to our petrodollar system. And, back then, we were in Cold War. And so I've seen some analysts make the argument that, say, back then it could have made more sense because it increased, basically we sacrificed some degree of domestic vibrancy for, basically what you can refer to as an empire. We basically extended our hegemonic reach. Mm-hmm. And so that had various trade-offs back then. It had some pros, it had some cons, depending on what side of that equation you were on. But now it's at the point where it's not even really serving the hegemonic benefits anymore, and some of those downsides have gotten really big. And one thing I point out in the article is that China, for example, has been using the petrodollar system against us as well. So in addition to some of these countries beginning to go around the system and use non-dollar payment systems for energy, some of them have also been really benefiting with mercantilist policies from this the way the system's currently structured. And so it's really not even benefiting the U.S. anymore, let alone the U.S. middle class that it's been hurting for a while.
Right. The U.S. middle class has been hurting for a while. Coming from Ohio, where I come from, my father was a machinist in around Canton, Ohio, the northeastern part of Ohio. I remember in the 60s and the 50s, especially as a young kid, how we were very optimistic about things in that part of the world, that the St. Lawrence Seaway had just been developed, and well, we were going to be almost like a coastal region of the country. But then things changed as with this monetary system, and the Rust Belt, or the middle America, the people that actually produce things, I like to say the miners, the manufacturers, the farmers, the inventors, maybe the farmers not as much, but people that actually do things seem to have gotten hurt very badly. And I would suggest that that's one of the reasons that Donald Trump was elected, was this idea that maybe somehow that part of the country could be brought back again. But it doesn't seem to be. It doesn't seem to be happening as long as... Well, here's the thing. I want to ask you about Robert Triffin. If you could explain to our listeners a little bit about Triffin's dilemma, and because you talk about the atrophy that's built into this petrodollar system. Maybe just talk a little bit about that, if you would, Lynn.
Yeah, so Robert Triffin was an economist. And so back when the Bretton Woods system was constructed, there were some economists, including him from the beginning, that said the system would ultimately fail. And basically, what he pointed out is that that the United States would run capital count issues, and so basically, what would happen is that the United States only had so much gold; they had a tremendous amount of gold, but the amount of liabilities on that gold, because dollar was convertible to gold for foreigners, and so as the foreign official sector had more and more dollars, they redeemed those for gold. And eventually, our gold reserves were no longer enough to satisfy our liabilities, especially because, as you pointed out, in the late 60s and early 70s, they were engaging in pretty big deficits for wars and for domestic programs. And so that made the gold standard really hard to maintain. And eventually, basically, the foreign sector called the bluff on it, and Nixon had to basically end that system because it was no longer mathematically sustainable. Now, since that system ended, the Triffin's dilemma has been reapplied to the petrodollar system, and it's basically in this version, it goes that in order to supply dollars around the world for all of this energy pricing, there's only a couple ways to do it, and the easiest way that it works is that the U.S. ends up running really big trade deficits, and so the same kind of flaw that brought down the Bretton Woods system. Is you basically manifest again in a slightly different way in the petrodollar system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it seems to me this notion that you have to have this enormous export deficit, that you have to run these deficits, trade deficits, that, in order to keep enough liquidity out there to keep the dollar out there, so that it can be the world's reserve currency. It seemed to me when the United States was leading the way with so-called free trade that we were basically cutting our tariffs more than other countries were required to cut theirs. And it seems to me that may have been a policy measure in order to retain this system. But I'm not sure if that was intentional or not, but it seems to be what happened. And again, I think Donald Trump might have been a reaction to that. So Triffin really sort of saw, or at least as you say, it's being applied now to the petrodollar system. I'd like to ask you, how then is China using, you mentioned that China is now using the petrodollar system against the United States. Maybe you could explain that.
Yeah, sure. So basically the downside of the petrodollar system for the U.S., as you mentioned, is those persistent trade deficits. Now some of the upside for it, while it works, is that foreigners finance part of the U.S. government deficits, which can feel really good while it's happening, and it's been happening, and it's been happening for decades. So, an entire generation or two has really benefited from that. And so, in the beginning, our major trade partner was Europe. So, Europe would run really big, trade surpluses with us. They'd get a lot of dollars, and then they'd reinvest a lot of those dollars into holding U.S. treasuries as their foreign exchange reserves. And so they would basically cycle those dollars back into financing our government deficits. Then with the rise of Japan, you know, that center of you know, dollar flow kind of shifted over, and so Japan ran really big trade surpluses with us, and again they cycled those dollars back into buying treasuries. Then roughly, you know, about 20 years ago, we started to see the sharp rise of China, and so they became the ones that ran the biggest trade surpluses with us. And again, they cycled their dollars back into buying treasuries, and they eventually accumulated over $1 trillion worth of treasuries. But then in 2013, China said it's really no longer in our best interest to keep buying treasuries, and so we're not going to do that anymore. And then instead, they announced the Belt and Road Initiative, which is basically that they started making dollar loans to developing countries around the world to develop infrastructure or to secure commodity rights. You know, mm-hmm. because China is, of course, a very large commodity importer. And is now the biggest commodity importer. And so they are still running very large trade surpluses with the United States, but then they're taking those dollars and then they're basically securing all their own commodity rights and basically buying hard assets around the world rather than recycling those dollars back into buying treasuries. And that's, of course, you know, over time led to you know, more and more kind of geopolitical conflicts between the United States and China. And it basically, you know, no one cared as much about the trade deficit many years ago when China was, you know, putting a lot of that money back into U.S. deficits and mm-hmm. treasuries. But now, of course, we care a lot more because China is no longer cycling those dollars back into treasuries and they're doing their own thing. And so the United States is really on the short end of the stick here, you know, ironically, with the system that they constructed all these decades ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so we've depended on the kindness of strangers, as some people have put it in the past, to buy our treasuries, you know, recycling those export dollars, those export earnings into the U.S. treasuries. And now nobody wants treasuries. I can't blame them. They're paying nothing. They're paying less than nothing, in real terms, at least. And, you know, we're still dependent on foreigners, except now the central bank has to step in and start to buy our treasuries because no one else wants them, right? I mean, there's some pension funds and the like that have to buy some. But for the most part, it doesn't make a lot of sense to go buy treasuries now. And so people are buying stuff. They're buying tangibles, I think, more investors.
Yeah, exactly. There's still some demand for treasuries. It's you know, some institutions have to use it for collateral. And if you look at Japanese investors, for example, they pay close attention to FX hedged treasury yields compared to, you know, their own government bond yields. And so there's kind of this demand around the margin, but it's just not enough demand to keep up with the massive amount of new supply. And so foreign holdings of treasuries have been relatively flat over the past year, even though U.S. supply of those treasuries has ballooned by trillions of dollars. And so the Federal Reserve has become the largest buyer. And now actually, the Federal Reserve holds more treasuries than all foreign central banks combined. Mm.
Wow.
And so that basically is, I've used the analogy, like we're a restaurant that, you know, where the cook is eating her own cooking more than her customers are.
Not a good situation. And China, on the other hand, I mean, we owe all this money to other countries yet, other countries that are holding treasuries. And China, though, isn't in the same position. I think they are not beholden to other countries so much, right? If anything,
yeah,
they're...
Yeah, so they are a net creditor nation, meaning
exactly,
they own...
Exactly, as
they
we were at one point.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, and so just with a couple of minutes left here yet, Lynn, I would like to just mention to Alistair McLeod's article, The Next Dollar Problem Has Just Arrived. I don't know if you happen to read Alistair or if you follow his work at all, but he's pointing out that in the last 2 weeks we've seen M1 increase by 14%. That's not 14% per annum, that's 14% in 2 weeks, and he's pointing out that that has come at the expense of M2, which he says is largely because banks aren't lending money now. Banks are afraid to lend money. The economy is not reviving as they had expected it would shortly after COVID sprung up. And Alistair is really concerned that we could see a disintegration of the dollar fairly quickly. I don't know to what extent, with a minute left, you might share those concerns or not.
I think it's something to watch. I mean, as you correctly pointed out, that was mostly a shift from M2 to M1, and so uh-huh. you know, it's basically you know, instead of savings accounts, it's been in demand deposits like checking accounts, and so it's something to watch. Ironically, in the near term, that can potentially strengthen the dollar because if banks are not lending dollars, then it's harder to get dollars. And as we've talked about in previous discussions, the foreign sector has a lot of dollar-denominated debt as well as dollar-denominated assets. And so whenever the dollar gets really tight, sometimes you get this mad rush into dollars as a safe haven. So in the near term, that could ironically potentially give it a little increase. And in fact, in the last couple of days, we have seen a little bit of a bounce in the dollar index. And so I'm mostly focusing on the long term rather than, you know, what might happen over a 3 to 6 month period.
Well, there was so much more I wanted to ask you about. I'm sorry we don't have time. Certainly, I know you're gold. You're into Bitcoin. You do put out a newsletter, and people can learn to know, a very reasonably priced newsletter as well, and people can learn to know what you're doing and what you're advising your clients to do. So I want to thank you so much, Lynn, for being with us. Always a pleasure. It's always enlightening and very helpful for our listeners. So thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. All right, folks. Well, that is it for this week. Next week, Charles Hugh Smith will be my main guest, and we'll also be talking to Jim Gregg of Benchmark Metals. So until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Noble Resources Corp. trades on the OTCQX under the symbol NSRPF and on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol NVO. Its flagship assets are located in the Pilbara region of Western Australia. Novo has recently partnered with Sumitomo Corporation of Japan to evaluate, advance, and develop the company's Australian gold projects. With over $40 million in cash and $60 million committed from Sumitomo, Novo is well on its way to establishing itself as one of the top junior explorers and developers in Australia.